attention. Chapter 6 Conversations with the Greenspan. Over the years, I've had many interesting interchanges with Federal Reserve chairmen. The most occurred with Alan Greenspan. He fascinated me the most because of my early exposure to his support for the gold standard and disdain for the Federal Reserve and paper money. I was a subscriber to Ayn Rand's Objectivist newspaper of the 1960s and studied closely Greenspan's 1966 article, Gold and Economic Freedom, in that publication. I told him that he had made a favorable impression on me once. He always was aware of exactly where I was coming from, and at times, even when I did not explicitly mention gold in my questions, he would answer in the context of the gold standard. Although frequently annoyed, and more so as the years went on, he never seemed quite as annoyed or dismayed as Ben Bernanke is with my questions. Greenspan's claim, in an answer to one of my questions, was that the central bankers essentially had become smart enough to achieve all the benefits of the gold standards without its limitations. Of course, it's the limitations that are so valuable, and the reason the gold standard is so important to a free society. These thoughts he stated brilliantly in his own historic article, Gold and Economic Freedom. In the absence of the gold standard, there is no way to protect savings from confiscation through inflation. There is no safe store of value. If there were, the government would have to make its holding illegal, as was done in the case of gold. If everyone decided, for example, to convert all his bank deposits as silver or copper or any other good, and thereafter decline to accept checks as payments for goods, bank deposits would lose their purchasing power, and government-credited bank credit would be worthless as claims on goods. The financial policy of the welfare state requires that there be no way for the owners of wealth to protect themselves. This is the shabby secret of the welfare statists' tirades against gold. Deficit spending is simply a scheme for the confiscation of wealth. Gold stands in the way of this insidious process. It stands as a protector of property rights. If one grasps this, one has no difficulty in understanding the statists' antagonism toward the gold standard. According to his own logic, Greenspan had simply become a statist. I once asked Greenspan about his views on the work of Mises and the Austrian economists. Here is a transcript from June 25, 2000. Ron Paul. Basically, the way I understand the Austrian free market explanation of a business cycle is once we embark on inflation, the creation of new money, we distort interest rates and we cause people to do dumb things. They overinvest. There is malinvestment, there is overcapacity, and there has to be a correction, and the many good members, or well-known members of the Austrian school, I am sure you are well aware of them, Mises, Hayek, and Rothbard, as well as Henry Hazlitt, have written about this, and really did a pretty good job on predicting. It was the reason I was attracted to their writing, because certainly Mises understood clearly that the Soviet system wouldn't work. In the 1920s, the Austrian economic policy explained what would probably come in the 1930s. None of the Austrian economists were surprised about the bursting of the bubble in Japan in 1989, and Japan, by the way, had surpluses. And of course, the best prediction of the Austrian economist was the breakdown of the Bretton Woods Agreement, and that certainly told us something about what to expect in the 1970s. But the concerns from that school of thought would be that we still are inflating. Between 1995 and 1999, our M3 money supply went up 41%. It increased during that period of time twice as fast as the GDP, contributing to this condition that we have. We have had benefits as a reserve currency of the world, which allows us to perpetrate the bubble, the financial bubble. Because of our huge current account deficit, we are now borrowing more than $1 billion a day to finance, you know, our prosperity, and most economists, whether they are from the Austrian school or not, would accept the notion that this is unsustainable and something would have to happen. Even recently, I saw a statistic that showed total bank credit out of the realm of day-to-day activity and control of the Fed is increasing at the rate of 22%. We are now the biggest debtor in the world. We have a $1.5 trillion foreign debt, and that now is 20% of the GDP. And these statistics concern many of the economists as a foreboding of things to come. And my question dealing with this is, where do the Austrian economists go wrong? And where do you criticize them and say that we can't accept anything that they say? My second question deals with productivity. There are various groups that have said that our statistics are off. Estevao and Locke claim, and this was written up in the St. Louis Fed pamphlet, that the temps aren't considered, and that distorts the views. Stephen Roach at Morgan Stanley said, "We don't take into consideration overtime." Robert Gordon of Northwestern University says that 99% of the productivity benefits were in the computer industry and had very little to do with the general economy, and therefore, we should not be anxious to reassure ourselves that the productive increases will protect us from future corrections that could be rather serious. Alan Greenspan. Well, I will be glad to give you a long academic discussion on the Austrian school and its implication with respect to modern views of how the economy works, having actually attended a seminar of Ludwig Mises when he was probably 90, and I was a very small fraction of that. So, I was aware of a great deal of what those teachings were, and a lot of them still are right. There is no question that there have been absorbed into the general view of the academic profession in many different ways, and you can see a goodly part of the teachings of the Austrian school in many of the academic materials that come out in today's various journals, even though they are rarely, if ever, discussed in those terms. We have an extraordinary economy with which we have to deal both in the United States and the rest of the world. What we find over the generations is that the underlying forces which engender economic change themselves are changing all the time, human nature the sole apparent constant throughout the whole process. I think it is safe to say that economists generally continuously struggle to understand which particular structure is essentially defining what makes the economy likely to move in one direction or another in the period immediately ahead, and I will venture to say that that view continuously changes from one decade to the next. We had views about inflation in the 1960s, and in fact, the desirability of a little inflation, which we no longer hold anymore, at least the vast majority no longer hold as being desirable. The general elements which contribute to stability in a market economy change from period to period as we observe that certain hypotheses about how the system works do not square with reality. So all I can say is that the long tentacles, you might say, of the Austrian school have reached far into the future from when most of them practiced and have had a profound and, in my judgment, probably an irreversible effect on how most mainstream economists think in this country. Ron Paul. You don't have time to answer the one on productivity, but in some ways, I'm sort of hoping you would say, don't worry about these Austrian economists. Because if you worry too much about them, and these predictions they paint in the past came true, in some ways we should be concerned, and I would like you to reassure me that they are absolutely wrong. Alan Greenspan. Let me distinguish between analyses of the way economies work and forecasts people make as a consequence of those analyses. The remarkable thing about the behavior of economies is that they rarely square with forecast as much as one should hope they did. I know there is a big dispute on the issue of productivity data. I don't want to get into that. We would be here for the rest of the month. I think the evidence, in my judgment, is increasingly persuasive that there has been an indeed underlying structure change in productivity in this country. Prior to one of our biannual meetings with Greenspan, we were given a photo opportunity. Since it was a scheduled event, I brought with me my copy of the original faded green Objectivist newspaper of 1966. During the short visit and picture-taking, I showed him a copy of the letter and asked if he recalled the newsletter, which he quickly acknowledged. Upon opening the small booklet to his Gold and Economic Freedom article, I asked if he would autograph the article for me, which he promptly did. As he was signing the article, I asked if he would like to put a disclaimer on it. Astoundingly, he answered that he had just recently reread it and wouldn't change a word of it. In a hearing July 21, 2004, the exchange in which I discussed the housing bubble went as follows. Ron Paul. As the economy slowed in 2000-2001, of course, there was an aggressive approach by inflating and lowering the interest rates to an unprecedented level of 1%. But lo and behold, when we look back at this, we find out that manufacturing really hasn't recovered. Savings hasn't recovered. The housing bubble continues. The current account deficit is way out of whack, continuing to grow as our foreign debt grew, and consumer debt is rising as well as government debt. So it looks like this 1% really hasn't done much good other than prevent the deflating of the bubble, which means that, yes, we have had a temporary victory, but we have delayed the inevitable, the pain and suffering that must always come after the distortion occurs from a period of time of inflating. So my question to you is, how unique do you think this period of time is that we live in and the job that you have? To me, it is not surprising that half the people think you are too early and the other half think you are too late on raising rates. But since fiat money has never survived for long periods of time in all of our history, is it possible that the funnel of tasks that you face today is a historic event, possibly the beginning of the end of the fiat system that replaced Bretton Woods 33 years ago? And since there is no evidence that fiat money works in the long run, is there any possibility that you would entertain that, quote, we may have to address the subject of overall monetary policy not only domestically but internationally in order to restore real growth? Alan Greenspan. Well, Congressman, you are raising the more fundamental question as to being on a commodity standard or another standard. And this issue has been debated, as you know as well as I, extensively for a significant period of time. Once you decide that a commodity standard such as the gold standard is, for whatever reasons, not acceptable in a society, and you go to a fiat currency, then the question is automatically, unless you have government endeavoring to determine the supply of the currency, it is very difficult to create what effectively the gold standard did. I think you will find, as I have indicated to you before, that most effective central banks in this fiat money period tend to be successful largely because we tend to replicate that which would probably have occurred under a commodity standard in general. I have stated in the past that I have always thought that fiat currencies by their nature are inflationary. I was taken back by observing the fact that from the early 1990s forward, Japan demonstrated that fact not to be a broad universal principle. And what I have begun to realize is that because we tend to replicate a good deal of what a commodity standard would do, we are not getting the long-term inflationary consequences of fiat money. I will tell you, I am surprised by that fact. But it is, as best I can judge, a fact. On February 11, 2004, I directly challenged Greenspan on his power. Ron Paul. Friedrich Hayek was fond of saying that the managed economy was in danger because it was based on a pretense of knowledge that certain things the economic planners don't know, and, for instance, he would agree with me that we don't know, you don't know, the Congress doesn't know what the overnight rates ought to be, yet we reject the marketplace. But it is part of the system, and I understand that. But doesn't it ever occur to you that maybe there is too much power in the hands of those who control monetary policy, the power to create the financial bubbles, the power to maybe bring the bubble about, the power to change the value of the stock market within minutes? That, to me, is just an ominous power and challenges the whole concept of freedom and liberty and sound money. Alan Greenspan. Congressman, as I have said to you before, the problem you are alluding to is the conversion of a commodity standard to fiat money. We have statutorily gone into a fiat money standard, and as a consequence of that, it is inevitable that the authority, which is the producer of the money supply, will have inordinate power. And that is one of the reasons why I have indicated, because of that, and because of the fact that we are unelected officials, it is mandatory that we be as transparent as we conceivably can, and remember that we are accountable to the electorate and to the Congress. And the power that we have is all granted by you. We don't have any capability whatsoever to do anything without the agreement or even the acquiescence of the Congress of the United States. We recognize that, and one of the reasons I am here today is to endeavor to convey why we are doing what we are doing. And I will continue to do that, and I am sure that all of my colleagues are fully aware of the responsibility that the Congress has given us, and I trust that we adhere to the principles of the Constitution of the United States more so than one would ordinarily do. Greenspan's last appearance before the Financial Services Committee occurred on July 20, 2005. On this occasion, I pressed him hard about what kind of conditions would require him to reconsider the use of gold in the monetary system. Prefacing the question, I pointed out that central banks still hold gold, evidently on the belief that it does represent a monetary purpose. They hold no other commodities, and even though they have been selling gold over the years, there is still a lot of gold held by the International Monetary Fund and the central banks. Ron Paul, even you in the 1960s described the paper system as a scheme for the confiscation of wealth. Is it not true that the paper system that we work with today is actually a scheme to default on our debt? And is it not true that, for this reason, that's a good argument for people not, eventually, someday, wanting to buy treasury bills because they will be paid back with cheaper dollars? And aligned with this question, I would like to ask something dealing exactly with gold. If paper money, today it seems to be working rather well, but if the paper system doesn't work, when will the time come? What will the signs be that we should reconsider gold? Alan Greenspan. Well, you say central banks own gold, or monetary authorities own gold. The United States is a large gold holder. And you have to ask yourself, why do we hold gold? And the answer is essentially, implicitly, the one that you've raised, namely, that over the generations, when fiat monies arose and indeed created the type of problems, which I think you correctly identify of the 1970s, although the implication that it was some scheme or conspiracy gives it a much more conscious focus than actually, as I recall, it was occurring. It was more inadvertence that created the basic problems. But as I've testified here before to a similar question, central bankers began to realize in the late 1970s how deleterious a factor the inflation was. And indeed, since the late 70s, central bankers generally have behaved as though we were on the gold standard. And indeed, the extent of liquidity contraction that has occurred as a consequence of the various different efforts on the part of the monetary authorities is a clear indication that we recognize that excessive credit of liquidity creates inflation, which in turn undermines economic growth. So that the question is, would there be any advantage at this particular stage in going back to the gold standard? And the answer is, I don't think so. Because we're acting as though we were there. Would it have been a question at least open in 1971, as you put it? And the answer is yes. Remember, the gold price was $800 an ounce. We were dealing with extraordinary imbalances. Interest rates were up sharply. The system looked to be highly unstable. And we needed to do something. And we did something. Paul Volcker, as you may recall, in 1979, came into office and put a very severe clamp on the expansion on credit. And that led to a long sequence of events here, which we are benefiting from up to this date. So, I think central banking, I believe, has learned the dangers of fiat money, and I think as a consequence of that, we've behaved as though there are, indeed, real reserves underneath the system. So it looks like it will take high consumer price and the producer price inflation for Greenspan ever to give token reconsideration to gold. In the meantime, I believe many central banks of the world, as well as the IMF, will hold on to gold. What we are seeing is that the Western banks, the nations that have lived beyond their means, are selling gold at the same time the more growth-oriented countries in the East are buying gold. As for his claim that central bankers were behaving as if on a gold standard, the record of the 1990s indicates otherwise, and the result is the catastrophe that began in 2008. The message Greenspan was delivering in 1966 was quite different from his message and policy as Federal Reserve Board chairman. In one private conversation, he did acknowledge his association with Murray Rothbard, but volunteered no value judgment. Maybe Rothbard had been a favorable influence on Greenspan, since it was during that time that the excellent article on gold and freedom was written. In a way, it's pretty astounding. After inflating the currency endlessly for every correction and every political crisis during his tenure, he claimed that he recognized the danger of how excessive credit of liquidity creates inflation. Now, in the middle of possibly the greatest correction of credit creation of all history, Greenspan remains in denial as to his most significant contribution to the crisis. I would say that he never came close to achieving what he claimed, that he could get paper to substitute for gold when managed by wise central bankers. History will prove that goal is unachievable, and any sophistication in managing fiat currency may well delay corrections, but in doing so only allows a greater financial bubble to form. That's what today's crisis is all about. Many libertarians had actually advanced the theory that Greenspan was still a true believer and would advance the cause of sound money and freedom when appropriate. I never thought that a possibility, and as time moved on, I became more firmly convinced that pragmatism, a philosophic position Ayn Rand hated, drove Greenspan. Visited the House Committee on Oversight and Reform on October 24, 2008, and was welcomed as a distinguished Federal Reserve Board chairman. This was the final word on Greenspan. Most of his testimony was designed as an attempt to protect his reputation and to explain away his shortcomings as Federal Reserve Board chairman. His testimony was pathetic. He made the point that the computer programs that they were using to anticipate these problems were not well designed. The only reason there was an expansion of debt is there was an excessive demand for our debt. It was not a consequence of Federal Reserve Board policy. And to climax his arguments, he said that he did make a mistake, that indeed we did not have enough regulations on the market. In other words, create the conditions for malinvestment and compensate for them by having more government regulations. As the hearings were coming to a close, I could only conclude Greenspan is not John Galt. History will show that Greenspan, during his years as Fed chairman, 1987 to 2006, planted all the seeds of the financial calamity that erupted in 2007 and 2008. For the same reason a disease cannot be cured by more of the germ that caused it, the inflation and debt accumulation of the Obama years will not inflate our way out of it. This depression will likely last and last. If the depression lasts a decade or more, its length cannot be blamed solely on Greenspan. That blame will be placed on the current Federal Reserve Board, Congress, the President, the Treasury, but above all, the Keynesian economic policy, the same philosophy that gave us the Great Depression of the 1930s. The economic downturn is the necessary correction of the artificial boom period produced by the central bank's easy credit and artificially low interest rates. The duration itself is a consequence of the interference with the liquidation of debt and malinvestment and adjustment in prices of labor, goods, and services. It's too much to ask politicians or bureaucrats not to centrally plan the economy, especially when the market is struggling to rectify all the mistakes that come as a consequence of the Federal Reserve Board policy.